Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The world of ichthyology is not as esoteric as it might sound. You just have to accept getting a little wet from time to time. Dr. Joe Nelson has made the study of fish his lifetime work, and at the recent International Conference of Ichthyologists in Kansas City, he was honored for his many scientific achievements. And over at the Alberta Research Council, another crowd with an international bent met to discuss the research and development of new technologies for the use of alternative fibers. Straw and hemp were two of the stars showcased at Fibrex 2002. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. With over 25,000 species of fish to deal with, there's no shortage of work for fish biologists, or ichthyologists as they're known in scientific circles. Ichthyologists from around the world recently met in Kansas City to discuss everything from the discovery of new species to the devastating environmental impacts of introduced species. Among the scientists attending this international conference was Dr. Joe Nelson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Alberta and author of Fishes of the World and Fishes of Alberta.
Well, there were a lot of exciting talks at this particular conference. People came from Russia talking about problems of exotic fish introduced there, and there were a lot of talks on problems that you may have seen in the newspapers, like snakeheads, swamp eels, and Dr. John Volpe of this university gave a very interesting talk on the Atlantic salmon, which have been introduced and are reproducing off the coast of British Columbia, which is not good news.
Why is it that exotic species is becoming such an issue?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, I asked that. I was wondering why now? Why are we hearing of all of these exotic fish, including in the ocean? We have lionfish now reproducing in the Atlantic Ocean where they do not occur naturally. And they've been found all the way from New York to the Bahamas and over to back into Florida. Then snakehead, swamp eels, and it just seems that a lot of people are bringing in these things through the pet trade and bringing in live things in the food market, and then very irresponsibly releasing these things in the wild where they can do a great deal of harm. So it is a very serious matter. But you sort of wonder, why now? Well, maybe better transportation and just more people doing these things.
At the conference, did people talk about things that could be done in order to put a halt to this problem or at least stem it in some way?
Yes, it was seen that we've got to do a lot more by way of regulation. To a certain extent, the aquarium market, the food market, these things have been poorly regulated. People could bring in things. And I guess we've sort of acted on a matter of trust that people wouldn't be so stupid then as to take these things that they no longer wanted and release them into the wild. And, you know, now this has happened with devastating results. In some cases, it's going to be cause enormous harm. So we now feel that now is the time, you know, there's going to have to be strong legal actions. And this is always unfortunate because it means that some people are going to be inconvenienced. But if there's going to be a certain number of people doing these things, releasing things, then, you know, there has to be strong action. So I think we're going to see more regulations put into place.
Well, this problem with exotics, I was reading an article actually on the bulletin board just outside of your office about one researcher in BC who had went back to his lake to do some more work on what seemed to be a new species developing from sticklebacks, discovered they were all gone because someone had put catfish in the lake.
Yes, that's right. That's another case where it's very, well, this whole situation is interesting because on a few islands between Vancouver Island and the mainland, there's a very exciting examples of evolution in action where we see new forms, new species of sticklebacks that have evolved. Now, in this case, very unfortunately, while this lake was being studied, someone had put in catfish, presumably because they liked to fish for a catfish and wanted a local supply, dumped them in very illegally. It wasn't done by government biologists. And these things are serious predators, and they apparently caused the extinction of what we are quite confident was a new biological species. So there's something lost to science. We can no longer go back there and study that sort of thing. So that's just one example of many.
Well, that's the problem with exotic species and new species. Are there new species that are still being introduced around the world that came up at this conference?
Well, yes, it's surprising. All over the world, it seems people are spreading around species, but you mentioned new species. One exciting thing at this conference was the number of new species that are still being found, species new to science, not just in big rivers like the Amazon and in the deep parts of the ocean where you might expect there to be unknown species, but we're finding new species in populated areas right in the United States, in states like Kentucky, Missouri, Tennessee. Biologists are doing more detailed studies and finding new species, and that's encouraging, especially in the face of finding certain species becoming extinct through various actions and or extirpated. That's where a species loses its range and part of its area through various environmental changes. So when we find new species, that gives rise to hope, too. It's encouraging.
Can you give me examples of some of these new species?
Well, a lot of them have been darters. Most of these are small fish, not things that attract a great deal of attention, because let's face it, if they attracted a lot of attention, they'd have been found a long time ago. But some of them are these little darters. We have a few darters in Alberta. A lot of them are minnows, small little fish. But sometimes large things show up. And in the ocean, for example, there's megamouth, this large-mouthed shark, which was found several years ago. And not many have been found, maybe 20 or so far. But sometimes big things are found, which is kind of exciting because you don't think of these big things still being found. But they are.
Now, you chaired a committee while you were at the conference that dealt with the names of fishes. And what are the issues that are outstanding there?
Well, we have this committee, just to backtrack a bit, that I chair, consisting of seven people, two of us from Canada, three from the United States, and two from Mexico. And we are revising a list that will be the accepted scientific and common names of fishes of North America. So here we provide a list to stabilize the common name so the public can be informed as to what a certain species of fish is. And, you know, I think the public is always confused when they go to the fish market or a restaurant and see a name. And people selling fish often use erroneous names, trying to mislead the public, I think. And so we have this list of accepted common names that are intended to help people, guide people as to what they are looking at. Now, we have a whole host of issues here. We've changed the names of a number of fish to do away with names that are offensive, and we've had some of these carried over from the past, and we've published upon this. We also have a case of, well, Chinook salmon, for example. You may think this is trivial, mundane, but Chinook salmon, it's always been spelled with a small C, but in doing research into the Chinook Indian tribe, in the United States, it's seen that this is truly a distinct group, and the name of the fish is now going to be spelled with a capital C, Chinook salmon. So from that, we go on into all of these new species that are being found. Each one is given a new common name. Now, when they're described, they're automatically given a scientific name. Otherwise, they wouldn't be considered a valid species. So that's where the author of the species has his or her job. We then give a common name if one hasn't been suggested by the author of the species.
Can you give me some examples other than the Chinook salmon?
Yes. For each, the Chinook salmon was one case where we provided this little tweaking of a name change, but otherwise in the past, in the case of the fish names that we've changed, squawfish comes to mind, where this was deemed to be an offensive name to many people, so we've changed its name to pike minnow. Apart from that, a basic tenet of our committee is to keep common names stable. So, for example, to show you the importance of this, rainbow trout. Here's a name that everyone knows. A rainbow trout is a rainbow trout. People's grandparents will know rainbow trout by that name, and grandchildren will know the name by that name, I hope. But the scientific name has undergone a big change. 20 years ago, people referred to rainbow trout under the scientific name of Salmo gairdneri. Today, it's known as Oncorhynchus micus. So the whole name has undergone a complete change, but the common name has stayed the same. So this we see as the big function, big use of common names. Stability, and people will know it under one name, even though there's changes in evolutionary thinking in terms of relationships.
You didn't come away from that conference empty-handed. You have an award.
Yes, I was delighted at the banquet, the very last event of this conference, to receive the Robert H. Gibbs Jr. Memorial Award. So this is presented for an outstanding body of published work in systematic ichthyology. And I was especially delighted not just to win it, but also to be the first Canadian to win it. So it was a great pleasure. And I think even though it's presented for a lifetime of accomplishments, it was presented largely for my book, Fishes of the World, which is in its third edition, and I'm working on the fourth edition right now as we speak.
Now, you say you've got lots more work going. You've got another edition of your book coming out. It's pretty hard to be a retired professor when you've got all this work on your plate.
Well, yes, and I can imagine being retired and have nothing to do, but there's revising Fishes of the World, and Martin Pates and I will be revising the Fishes of Alberta in a few years' time, and I'll be continuing working on this committee for fish names of North American fishes, and there's a lot of other things going on in the fish world, too. It's all exciting, and that's what's a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Cheryl. Glad to do it.
That was Dr. Joe Nelson. Just retired in June, he is now a professor emeritus at the University of Alberta. He's also acting associate dean in the Faculty of Science, and he's the winner of the prestigious Robert H. Gibbs Jr. Memorial Award for his lifetime contributions to the study of ichthyology. Fibrex 2002. No, that has nothing to do with the latest in bran muffins. Fibrex 2002 is a symposium recently organized by the Alberta Research Council. It brought together people who are developing new technologies to use fiber, be it from trees, flax, straw, or even hemp. One of those brave people risking it all in the world of alternative fibers is Neil Oberg. A farmer from Forestburg, Neil is also the co-chair of the Alberta Agricultural Research Institute. Where others have failed, Neil is determined to make a go of the strawboard plant he operates near Forestburg.
Well, I guess the approach that I took, or the perspective I came from, was from the producer side. I see that there's an opportunity for creating value in addition to the grain we raise, and I wanted to try and develop that into a value-added industry that would fit into Alberta.
What are some of the challenges that you're facing right now?
The challenges, I guess, would probably, I could lump them into two areas. The first one would be technology. The technology that we utilized in our operation had certain limitations that we learned through trial and error. We have since identified what those limitations are, and we're in the process of fixing them, making it work much more effectively and efficiently. The second one is financing, the availability of venture capital. It's not easy to place capital for a startup company of any kind. And if you've got one that is a strawboard facility, which the background in Canada has been less than wonderful, it's a challenge. But there are a lot of people, there are a few people, I should say, who accept that challenge, who look at it as an opportunity rather than a negative sort of a thing, and they step forward and are going to make it work.
What are you doing that's different, that's going to overcome these problems that other people have tried to get the strawboard plants going, up and running? They always tend to fall apart.
When we were running and when we did have problems, we documented what all those problems were. Anytime we were stopped for any reason more than 3 minutes, we documented that. We took all that information and out of that identified where we need to do the improvements. And so that's what we're doing right now, making those improvements. It's parts of the operation that maybe weren't inherent in the technology itself right from the start. But some of the things, like the in-feed, for example, that we have to improve so that we can give the internal equipment inside the plant the opportunity to make a really good product.
What is it that you're making?
We're making a fiber board. It's like a particle board, very similar in visual appearance. It's almost identical to a wood-based particle board. The big difference, I guess, is that it is moisture-resistant, and it has no formaldehyde in it, so there's no off-gassing.
What help have you been getting from the Alberta Research Council?
The Alberta Research Council has a very good facility for testing board. We are in the process of lining up an arrangement with them to test our board on a continuous basis. They also have the capability for research and development into new areas that we might want to move into in the future. And it's those two areas that we're mainly interested in with the Research Council.
Just looking at the way the weather is this year with the drought, and it looks like it may continue beyond this year, are farmers even really going to be interested in getting into all these other things if they don't know what the outcome is going to be?
I guess the farmer who says he knows what the outcome is going to be in the spring is probably what his fall outcome is going to be is probably few and far between. But if we can introduce a little bit of predictability into his operation, probably 25 years out of 26, he's going to have sufficient straw that could possibly be sold. It is an income-earning opportunity for him. And if we can locate some of these industries in the rural areas that are close to his farm, we feel that they will work the opportunity for sale of the straw into his overall production system, and that it actually would be a very nice fit.
Is this something then where you would set up these straw plants fairly close together, as opposed to having one main facility where you had to draw upon product being transported over long distances?
Yeah, our project is characteristically small, especially when compared to the world-scale particle board mills that we're used to seeing here in Canada. It's about a tenth of the size. The main reason for that is access to raw material. Carrying straw long distances is like carrying a truckload of feathers long distances. It's extremely expensive. So we see making the plants small, keeping them small, locating them in several areas throughout rural communities gives us the logistical advantage of a lower cost access to the straw, and it also creates employment opportunities for rural communities, which are certainly lacking in very many opportunities for that sort of thing.
Now, you're not just concerned with your own plant. You're also looking at getting the word out to other people. How are you doing that?
Well, I do about three different things. One of them is farming. One of them is in the straw board plant. The other one is with the Agriculture Research Institute for this province. We have formed networks which are going to be the functional logistical operation part of research and development to get funds into research activity that are collaborative, that are strategically focused, and that are ultimately effective for getting results for first place and getting those results communicated to the users.
What kinds of things are you trying to say to people?
I think the main message is that if we're looking for an opportunity to improve our economy right now in Alberta and, in fact, in Canada, we have to start with research and development. That's where it starts. That's where we gain the understanding. But we can't do it in isolation from all of the other parts of the production continuum.
Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you very much.
That was Neil Oberg, farmer and operator of a strawboard plant near Forestburg. He's also the co-chair of the Alberta Agricultural Research Institute. Another fiber innovator and entrepreneur at the Alberta Research Council's Fibrex 2002 was Lance Vandenborn. Owner of the company Thompson Valley Farms, Lance doesn't actually own a farm, but he deals with farmers who grow what some might see as a controversial crop, and that's hemp, the plant that produces marijuana. Struggling to figure out what to call him, I nixed the term dealer, Perhaps Lance could be classed as a hemp broker.
Well, I don't really like the term broker because it implies the middleman's status, but more what I do, I suppose, is I contract acres, and I contract facilities in town to add value to the different products. And then I release them through retailers.
Now, are these hemp products that are coming from Alberta or all over the place?
So far to date, everything I've purchased has been grown in Alberta. Unfortunately, I've purchased everything that has been grown. So now I have to go, looks like the next batch will have to come from Manitoba. But I do have acres growing in Alberta right now as we speak, mostly up in the Peace Country, and then again some more in the David Thompson region.
Whatever got you interested in hemp?
Wow. I was working on a farm, actually, and I attended a seminar in 1996 based on an experimental crop done in 95, where they had taken the fiber and the seeds and given them to U of A researchers. And I just tagged along. And I listened to these researchers, and I was astounded by the potential. So I listened, I watched for a couple years. It became legal in April 1st, 1998, actually. And that's when I got into it.
Are you making money?
Well, I mean, the checks do come in. I'll be honest about that. But, to be running in the black, we're not there yet.
Now, this is quite an interesting setup that you have. How did you decide to do it this way? Because you're not actually out there growing the stuff yourself.
Well, I don't have a farm, so what I had to do is look at the available options and take the ones that I could manage. So I had to start with the least value-added product, I suppose, which would be just the edible oil. And then from there, I can move to the more highly value-added products. So, I mean, my first product is the hemp seed oil, which I'm trying to launch into the grocery stores under the Thompson Valley name. And then what I really want to do is be producing fabrics made in Alberta, and ideally the whole shirt and pants and everything made right here in Alberta, made with Alberta crops.
What is the benefit or the advantage of hemp compared to other materials?
For the oil, it's clearly in the essential fatty acids. The omega-6 and 3 are balanced very closely to human body requirements, and they provide also, well, it also provides GLA of evening primrose oil, which is, noted for ligaments and tendons and whatever. But clearly it's a health food product right now. In terms of the fabrics, the fibers seem to be exceptionally strong in comparison to, say, cotton. And also, they can be made very soft. The fantastic linens can be made out of hemp. Whether we do it in Alberta or not remains to be seen. But I fully believe that we can actually produce fantastic crops here in Alberta for fabrics and also develop the infrastructure required to produce exceptional quality materials.
Now, that's the finished product. And what about the growing of hemp? Is this a good place to grow hemp?
There's two places in the world that might have better topsoil than us, one in the Ukraine and one in Argentina. So it's entirely possible that we have the third best growing condition in the whole world for this crop. We can do very well in Alberta, if only for the topsoil, but also for the rain. If we ever do get rain, then, we'll be able to produce fantastic crops here, definitely, for sure, in Alberta.
How many acres do you have?
Well, right now we've got 80 in the ground. I would have preferred to have about 120 to 160, but the farmers have to make the decision ultimately themselves.
How has this year been because of the drought conditions? Has that affected you and your farmers at all?
The crops in the Camrose area aren't doing very well, to be honest. In the words of the farmer out there, he said, we're in the middle of the Sahara, so hemp really does like a lot of moisture. But in the Peace River, they're doing okay. They had good moisture this spring. Haven't seen much lately, but the crop is still standing. It's well up, and it's about 75% of its final height and moving into flower. So if it's made it this far, it looks like it's going to do just fine.
For farmers who are interested in diversification, how does hemp compare as a crop to things like wheat and barley and oats?
Right now, the crop is a little bit harder to harvest than other crops just because the machinery isn't yet developed. So farmers are modifying their own machinery to accommodate it by, protecting bands. The fiber has a tendency to wrap around different parts of the machinery, so they have to put shielding in there. It's not that hard to do, but what it takes is a pretty well thought out approach to the modification of a combine, which it seems farmers are more than capable of doing on a large scale. they may not be able to sell the product, but boy, they can fix your truck.
How do you deal with the whole issue of consumer acceptance?
It's amazing, really, how much consumers already know about the product. When I did market surveys, you know, previous to launching my products, I talked to 50 or 100 people, and every one of them had heard of hemp. About 30% of them had heard that there was some kind of health benefit to the oil, albeit they didn't know what it was. But they did know that there was some kind of value there. And it seems that consumers, especially, you know, the younger generations, are nearly fanatical about the qualities of these products, and the desire to wear them is pretty amazing.
What is your message today to the people at the Fibrex 2002 conference?
What I guess I'm trying to say is that their fears are about being able to produce a product for a similar cost compared to other products. And my message is that even if it's a few dollars higher to the consumer, the market's there. Consumers are willing to pay for it, because I really do think that consumers have an ecological view that growing tree-free paper and producing linens in Alberta and not importing them from overseas markets is something worth doing. And I really think that people are willing to pay a couple of dollars extra for that option.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Lance Vandenborn, the brains behind the Thompson Valley Farms label, and an innovator who believes in the value of hemp as a new crop for Alberta farmers. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our website at innovationalberta.com. The program is sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.